Are you ready?
Welcome to First Amendment Friday on the Lars Larson Show.
Friday is for everybody.
Today, Lars puts you in the driver's seat. You talk about what you want to talk about.
Government is the problem.
No topic is off limits.
It looks like the Canadians are here.
Call 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-HEY-LARS.
Thank goodness it's Friday. Happy Friday.
This is
First Amendment Friday with Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show, and welcome to my favorite day of the week, the day in which we open up the phone lines on First Amendment Friday. Every subject is fair game, and I thought I'd start with Muslims and hijabs. You know, that face covering that Muslim women wear? Well, there's a fight that's been going on for the last couple of years, going all the way back to 2024, and it has to do with the Multnomah County Sheriff's Office and whether or not they're allowed to take mug shots of young ladies while they're wearing their hijabs, or are they allowed to make them remove those hijabs so you can actually take a picture of the person's face and be able to identify the person's face. Now, you might think, well, there's a logical answer to that, but hey, here in the Pacific Northwest, forget about logic. That went out the window a long time ago. But welcome to First Amendment Friday. If you want to jump into what we call the best conversation in talk journalism, it's here every day at 866-HEY-LARS. And on First Amendment Fridays or any other day of the week, if you're a naysayer, we're going to put you right to the head of the line at 866-439-5277. You can send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. And our ex-poll question today, in honor of this crazy decision in which the sheriff's office has effectively caved in and said, depending on your religion, you may end up with different rights depending on whether or not the sheriff's office is willing to accommodate your religious rights or not. Should Muslim suspects be able to have their mug shots taken while wearing a face covering hijab? I'll give you all the details in just a moment. You can find today's ex-poll question at Lars Larson Show and at LarsLarson.com, and brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at UltimateTruckService.com. So, the news is that the Multnomah County Sheriff's Office has settled a lawsuit. They came up with a settlement. It all started during a demonstration in 2024. And two young ladies were being booked, and they were forced to remove their head coverings, the hijab that covered their face and concealed who they were. Two Muslim sisters, Serene Abulhawa and Marjana Hassan, filed the lawsuit last year because in June of 2024, they were part of a pro-Palestinian demonstration during the Grand Floral Parade during Rose Festival. Well, once at the county detention center, the Daily Dead Fish rapper tells the story, they were ordered to remove their hijabs and keep them off in view of male officers, a violation of their faith. You know what? If you're being booked into custody, I want everybody being booked into custody to be treated equally. Meaning, if you're wearing a ball cap because you always wear a baseball cap, you get to take the baseball cap off. You may be required to remove all kinds of things that are on your face, whether they're about your religious faith or not. The complaint that was filed in court said that the sisters' booking photos were taken without their hijabs, with those photographs and security footage still available on a statewide database. Well, I got news for you. If you get arrested by a police agency and they take your mugshot, yes, your mugshot is going to be available not just to that police agency, but to other agencies. And then enters the front group for groups like Hamas, and that is CARE, the Council on American Islamic Relations. If you've been listening to this show long enough, you know that we've talked to IHOP before. That's Ibrahim Hooper, the guy who headed up CARE. CARE is the front group for all of these kinds of things. They represented the sisters in the lawsuit. And they got a $30,000 settlement, which means they pretty much got their attorney's fees, but they also got changes in policy. And what did they get out of all of that? Well, the CARE National Litigation Director, Lena Masri, Esquire, says this settlement represents a great outcome for both our clients and the Muslim women of this community. Muslim women in Multnomah County will no longer be forced to choose between their religious beliefs and complying with law enforcement officers. No, they're going to get special rights that nobody else gets. Here's the way they describe the change in policy. When you arrive at the jail, those who've been arrested are subject to do initial search with the covering still on. After that, the new policy has the arrestee taken to a separate cell by only a female officer, and then the covering can be removed for a search of the garment. The arrestee must then be supplied with a Multnomah County Sheriff's Office issued hijab. So in other words, we're going to create religious clothing that is created by a law enforcement agency only for use with Muslims who are arrested. The arrestee's covering is then placed by a female officer in their personal property bag. Male officers are not allowed to do that. And then when booking photos are taken, it can only be done with female staff members, one photo taken with the hijab, one without the face covering. But the latter, the one taken without face covering, cannot be viewed by male staff unless there is a legitimate reason to do so. Well, I would imagine if a police agency says, we need a picture of this person's mugshot, that's a legitimate reason. But to say you're not allowed to let male members of the sheriff's office actually examine a photo because it's a picture of a woman, that is treating somebody differently because of their religious beliefs. I don't think that's legitimate at all. The Constitution says that the government has to treat everybody and have respect for their faith. But does it say that people who are followers of one faith get special privileges that people who are followers of no faith or a different faith are not allowed to do? And then they say if somebody who's been arrested is then moved to housing, they must remove the hijab to be strip searched, but then they get to have the hijab back. Now, can you imagine the kind of chaos you can create in a jail when you have people within the jail and male people who work within the jail cannot identify the inmate in the jail because they don't know what the person looks like without a face covering on? They only know what they look like with the hijab on. And the vast majority of people who work in corrections are male, not female. And they say, well, then you'll have to have a female come and identify this person. If any of that makes sense to any of you, I'd be glad to take your phone calls at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. Our ex-poll question today, should Muslim suspects be able to have their mugshots taken while wearing a face-covering hijab? I would say no to that because wearing something over your face, it kind of belies the whole point of taking your picture in a mugshot. Your picture is supposed to be able to allow us to identify you. If you've got something covering your face, you cannot be identified. In any case, you can find the ex-poll question at Lars Larson Show and at LarsLarson.com. Coming up in just a moment, the Northwest nonsense, and then we'll get to your phone calls and emails on a First Amendment Friday. 866-439-5277. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network. With continued.
Lars Larson wants to hear from you, even if you disagree. Naysayers get to cut the line at 866-HEY-LARS. Now, here's Lars Larson.
That makes a lot of sense, a lot of nonsense.
Right, you're bloody well right. You know you got a right to say. This is the Northwest Nonsense.
How much longer do we have to sit for this nonsense?
That great moment every day where Lars brings you the cold, hard facts without any liberal wokeness from the Daily Dead fish wrapper or mainstream media bias.
Well, 25 years ago this September, I argued in favor of instituting private security for American airports after the terrorist attacks of 9/11. Well, I lost the argument back then to the folks who wanted security from a massive government bureaucracy now known as the TSA. Actually, the first bill, it is pointed out to me by my friend Seat Motley, he points out that the first bill actually called for private security paid for by the airlines, but then at the very last minute they changed the bill so the airlines don't pay for the security. It is paid for instead by the federal government. You know who made that happen? Mrs. Daschle. Tom Daschle was a top Democrat in the United States government. Mrs. Daschle was an airline lobbyist, and she managed to get that change made so that the government pays the bill instead of the airlines because she's an airline lobbyist. Frankly, I can't think of a single thing the government does better than the private sector. Congress funds the TSA unless Democrats decide they want to use it to make a political point, which they're doing these last couple of weeks. So 50,000 TSA screeners work without pay because the Democrat Party fears losing their illegal alien voters right before a major election. Wait times at American airports can now amount to 5 or 6 hours. The FAA warns that if the situation gets worse, they may have to close some airports altogether. We might have avoided all of this if we contracted for private security. 22 American airports now enjoy private security, including San Francisco International. It costs the same, it provides higher quality, and it wouldn't have to fall victim to Democrat Party tantrums on Capitol Hill. Meanwhile, I hope that every one of the millions of Americans who got stuck in the TSA at the airport in this whole mess, I hope they remember that at election time in November. Glad to get your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Our question of the day, brought to you by Multnomah Medical Clinic. No pills, no shots, no surgery, and you get better fast at Multnomah Medical Clinic. Jeff writes in from Lewiston, Idaho, listening on the Radio Northwest Network. Lars, you had a guy on early last week talking about ghost oil tankers and a massive storage of oil in places like Oklahoma. Can't remember his name. Since we get 56% of our oil from Canada and then Mexico, Saudi Arabia, Iran, and Brazil, only Saudi oil is affected by the Strait of Hormuz. I paid $2.08 a gallon for gasoline 4 weeks ago in Post Falls, Idaho. Today, it's $4.05. Can we get another expert on to explain the racket the oil companies run in America where we have so much oil accessible? The answer is Jeff Sayer in Lewiston, Idaho. My favorite email or ex post of the day is Los Angeles County is now home to almost 2,000 hospice centers. Now think about this for a moment. That is 30 times the number of hospice centers in Florida and New York and more than the next 36 American states combined. Gavin Newsom's California is littered with fraud. And now today's Daily Grill.
Insane.
Are you completely insane?
Ridiculous.
They get more and more ridiculous.
Flat out dumb.
You're even dumber than I thought.
Who deserves today's Lars Grill of the Day?
Maybe they're just really, really stupid.
Presented by Oregon City Garage Door.
I want to give today's Daily Grill to the Multnomah County Sheriff's Office for caving in to the Council on American Islamic Relations, known as CARE, and agreeing to have mugshots of suspects while wearing a face-covering hijab, which makes that mugshot basically useless. Today's best email, but you can always send more. This one comes from Paulski. Lars, well, now the libs are realizing that Cesar Chavez was a dirtbag, and they want to take his name off everything. We told you he was a dirtbag years ago when you forced residents and businesses to spend money changing addresses from 39th in Portland to Cesar Chavez. Let's hope the idiots running Portland government kept the old street signs, signed Paulski. To your calls now. It is First Amendment Friday. Let's start with Robin. Hey, Robin, welcome to the program. What's on your mind?
Hey, Lars. So I have a big issue. I don't even know where to begin with this issue. I'm a resident of Beaverton. I live off of Cornell and Highway 26.
Yeah.
The county bought a double tree hotel, an 85-bed double tree hotel.
Yeah.
That they were looking, we were told that it was going to be turned into a place for drug rehabilitation and recovery. We were a little bit skeptical at first.
No doubt.
You know, of course, we did some digging, and the digging brought us to this will also be a place for level 2 and level 3 sexual offenders post-prison. It will also be a place where violent criminal person-to-person offenders will be living.
Yep.
This place is within a mile of where there's 3,000 students within a one-mile radius. My son's school is an elementary school. It's a half a mile down the street.
Yep.
It is less than, it's 0.6 miles to Sunset High School. There's a dozen.
Hey, Robin, I know you want to continue with all the statistical data. You've convinced me, and we've talked about this issue before. You know, you've got communities that are having bad people shoved on their communities. What do you want to do?
Yep. Okay, well, here's what I'm calling about today is, we, in Washington County, we have, Harrington, our chair, is stepping down. We have Pam Treese, who is part of all of these centers, and we have Nafisa Fai, who is also part of opening these centers around our communities.
Vote them out.
We have a new candidate.
I mean, you're going to run out of time, Robin. I just have to warn you, you've got to have a concrete plan. Vote these people out of office. Bring the lawsuits you can bring. That's the only thing that's going to work at this point.
Okay, can I mention Jenny Campreth? She's our new a grassroots candidate. She's running for county chair against these people. She has helped other people, not other neighborhoods in the past. She's running again, and we need to get her reelected.
And I think getting her elected may be a key part of solving that problem. Robin, thank you very much. And sorry to hurry you along, but I knew we were going to hit the bottom of the hour. So I appreciate your call. A lot of communities are up against this same problem.
The Lars Larson Show. Talk, but want to be heard? Email Lars at talk@larslarson.com. He actually will read it. Now, here's Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I couldn't make up stuff as crazy as we actually see in the real news coverage out there. And one of the places we go to on a regular basis is the Center Square, which features today a story about how Seattle wants to put its real-time cop cameras on hold, primarily to protect illegal aliens, although they're calling it generically privacy concerns. I thought we'd get the full explanation from Randy Diamond, who's a reporter at the Center Square and joins me now. Randy, welcome back to the program. How are you?
Oh, good. Thank you, Lars.
Am I overstating what the Seattle mayor has done? Katie Wilson has come out and said, we're going to pause the expansion of police surveillance cameras because we're concerned about privacy issues. Now, were these issues an issue over the last several years as they've been putting in these cameras to begin with, or did they only become a privacy issue when ICE began picking up lots of illegal aliens?
Well, we also have a new mayor who ran on a platform of expressing concerns about these cameras to begin with. So certainly, Lars, the ICE enforcement plays into it quite a lot. I think you make a very good point.
I mean, because one of the things they've talked about doing is having enhanced cameras for the World Cup games. They're going to be played, what, later on this year? So apparently privacy there isn't the concern, but law enforcement or safety and security becomes the concern. Can you help me sort that one out?
Well, they actually, for the World Cup, they're making an exception. So they're going to install 26 cameras by Lumen Field where the games will be played in June and July. But Wilson says the cameras won't be turned on unless there's a, quote, credible security threat. And if there's that threat, they will be turned on.
Well, during something like the World Cup, isn't there, I mean, it seems like one of those things that's likely to be a target of negative attention. So they're going to leave the cameras turned off until the security threat emerges and then turn them on, but only as long as it takes to resolve the security threat and then turn them off. Does that make sense?
That is correct.
That's what they're going to do.
Well, I mean, I guess it's also the definition of what is a credible security threat, and is that going to be in time, Lars, to prevent the threat if they turn it on, you know, too late? So it's kind of, kind of the devil is in the details in a lot of these things, and we don't know, first of all, what is a credible security threat, and we don't know, kind of the protocol that they're going to go through to turn them on or turn them off. Obviously, there's a lot of geopolitical concerns given the World Cup being played, and certainly there could be threats. So you would think they would want to have the potential of having them on if necessary.
Well, and in fact, you made the point that you know, how do you know when it's a threat? And then what do you want to gather? Do you want to gather information? Say if somebody thinks that there's a terrorist group that's casing Lumen Field. Do you say, do we want to turn on the cameras only once something starts to happen or once a threat is phoned in? Or do we want to find out, hey, these people keep showing up in the vicinity of Lumen Field and they appear to be doing casing of this location, perhaps in preparation for a terrorist strike? But if they're not there during what is viewed as a credible threat, then you're not going to have the cameras on to capture their casing of the joint, right?
Right. No, I mean you make a great point. And again, really the devil is in the details as to, you know, when they would be turned on, what kind of intelligence would they need to, you know, make that determination. It's it would be ironic if they installed the cameras and there was a credible threat and then they turned them on too late to prevent, you know, anything from happening.
I'm talking to Randy Diamond, who's a reporter for the Center Square, and we check out the Center Square from time to time. This doesn't just affect the cameras that are in fixed positions on poles and buildings. It also affects the license plate readers that are apparently installed in hundreds of police vehicles in Seattle.
That's true, and also parking enforcement vehicles. She's put a pause on those readers, too. There was a new state law passed in the Washington State Legislature regarding those readers and how they should be regulated, and she's maintaining that she wants to read more about that law before allowing them to continue to operate. I mean, the larger question here, and this has happened at the Seattle City Council meetings, is can you have effective crime prevention without these cameras? And so you have kind of two groups here. You have the some of the poorer sections of Seattle community advocates coming up and talking about, high school students being killed by random gunfire and the dangers of the streets, and they're actually pushing for the continuation of these cameras and more cameras. And then you have the perhaps left-leaning groups who feel it's an intrusion on their civil liberties. So they're kind of both trying to get the mayor's attention.
And by the way, Randy, one of the ironies I see, this is a year when the state of Washington is passing an income tax. You say, well, have we had an income tax before? No. Well, then how are they going to know when you make enough money to actually qualify to have to pay the income tax? You say, well, they're going to have to take a look at how much money you make, which means at the same time, the state is intruding into everybody's financial, you know, dealings. How much money do you make? How much do you pay in taxes? How much is your gross overall income? All of that is going to be up for grabs. But the city of Seattle wants to make sure your picture doesn't get taken while you're driving down the road. It just seems a bit ironic to me that they don't seem to care so much about intruding into what most people consider very, very private matters. How much money do you make? How much did you make last year? How much do you pay in taxes? But they care an awful lot about whether or not somebody takes pictures of people when those pictures might actually affect, well, let's say, illegal aliens. That is Randy Diamond. He's a reporter at the Center Square. It's First Amendment Friday. Coming up in just a moment, I'm going to talk to a man who knew Chuck Norris well. Chuck Norris, you might have heard, has passed away at the age of 86. It is First Amendment Friday. We'll be glad to get your phone calls and emails at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. And you're listening to the Radio Northwest Network.
Interviews, podcasts, local and national news. Get it all at LarsLarson.com. Now, back to the Lars Larson Show.
Don't look now. Chuck Norris is right behind you.
I heard superheroes read Chuck Norris comics.
I heard at night the boogeyman checks into the bed for Chuck.
I heard Chuck Norris's reflection won't even look him in the eye.
I heard when cops need cops, they call Chuck Norris.
I heard when Chuck gets in the water, sharks get out of the ocean.
I heard when Chuck Norris is hiking, grizzlies look out for him.
I heard Chuck Norris rides a motor without the cycle.
I heard Chuck Norris wears a hat to protect the sun.
I heard medicine takes Chuck Norris to feel better.
I heard what actually killed the dinosaurs was Chuck Norris.
I heard cats say they have Chuck-like reflexes.
Yeah, that's just a sampling of some of the jokes about Chuck Norris. Iconic action star, and of course the star of Walker, Texas Ranger way back in the day. He has passed away at the age of 86, and I wanted to talk to a man who knew him very well, and that's my friend Terry Emmerich. Terry, how did you come to know Chuck Norris?
Well, about 20-some years ago, the friends of mine, the Kings from Houston, Texas, had me come down and meet Chuck, and then Chuck and I and Gina became friends, and then I've gone every year to support their Kickstart auction and had the opportunity of playing tennis with Chuck and then hanging out with Chuck at his ranch and meeting his mom, Wilma. Actually, I was there when she turned 100 years old.
Wow.
And this sweet little lady, and she lived on the ranch, had her own little house, and she had a lady there assisting her. She passed away about a year ago, and actually an artist here from Portland, Tanya Garland, had painted some pictures of Chuck that we sold at his auction and some of Bruce Lee, and they brought big bucks. And actually, she's just finishing up a portrait that I was supposed to give to Chuck because I was scheduled to go to the auction the 27th of April. And for the Kickstock auction, and she's just finishing up the portrait of his mom.
Kind of seemed like he would go on forever, didn't it?
Yeah, you know, he was in good shape, and you know, had a fall and had an injury, and one thing led to another. But just a really a great American hero. I'm hoping that Trump. We'll take our calls that we put in and fly a flag at half mast because he is a true American hero, not only in his service to our country, but his service to Kickstart. President Bush helped him get Kickstart into the Houston schools, and he saved so many thousands and thousands of kids and trained them for respect and trained them in karate. He was just one of a kind.
Yeah, he really was. And I'm sure that you're going to miss him terribly. Terry, I appreciate you coming on. Anything else you want to say about your friend Chuck Norris?
No. I just think everybody say a few prayers for him because he was a great American. And it's a tragic loss. I think I probably had over 100 messages today left on my phone just in the last 3 or 4 hours. And to everybody that sent those messages, I sincerely appreciate it.
Absolutely right. That's Terry Emmer. Terry, thank you very much. Let's go to Josh. Hey, Josh, it's First Amendment Friday. What's on your mind?
Hey, Lars. First of all, rest in peace, Chuck Norris.
Yes,
loved
sir.
Loved him growing up, seeing all his movies, and see his signs all over Clackamas County. I just wanted to comment on the hijab mugshot issue, and I 1,000% agree that they should have to take him off. That's just ridiculous. That you have a mugshot with a full face covering, it's useless, like you said.
Well, and the idea that they said you will be able to allow a female deputy to see the photo, but a male deputy may only look at the photo if it's justified. Look, if your face is in a mugshot book, you should be able to be seen by anybody that the mugshot book can be shown to. I mean, I've looked at mugshot books before, never so much to identify a suspect, but I've been with people who are going through that process. And to say, oh, these are people who have to be treated differently because of their faith. I want everybody's faith to be respected, but nobody gets superior rights simply because they're a follower of Islam.
1,000%, and I just, again, it's almost comical that they would even allow that. These days doesn't surprise me at all.
No, it really seems kind of crazy that you say, well, we're going to make these special exceptions because God knows we got to make sure that the Islam gets taken care of. Hey, Josh, thanks very much. I appreciate the time. By the way, this segment of the show is brought to you by 540training.com. That's concealed carry, home invasion defense, and personal defense. Find them online at 540training.com. Let's go to Mark. Hey, Mark, welcome to First Amendment Friday. What's on your mind?
Hi, Lars. I just wanted to do a follow-up on the call from the woman in Beaverton who was commenting on how the council had allowed certain criminal elements to be in the facility that they're remodeling or whatever.
Yep. Millions of dollars into a motel. And it's being done. Almost every community on the West Coast is doing this kind of thing, and I don't think it does anybody any good.
Right. Well, so I had a similar experience actually in the city of Milwaukee about 15 years ago where they were changing who could come into these facilities in neighborhoods, basically. And I went to the council meeting and they were reading it off and they were saying, well, these criminals, type one or type two, whatever they were going to pass this. And they had a session where you can stand up and say what you want to say. And I said, that's fine. You're passing these code 2 and 3. I would like you to read out loud what type of criminals those are. And there were a couple council members who said, no, we shouldn't do that. And thank God there was a council brave enough to say, no, we really should. Because I said, look, you guys are passing this. If bad things happen in the future, you can't say you didn't know who you're allowing into these facilities.
Yep.
And it would turn you white to hear what they were what they were putting in these facilities.
What was it? Violent criminals, sexual criminals, that sort of thing?
Yeah, sexual criminals, a lot of sexual criminals.
And so they're going to put these people in so-called transitional housing. And by the way, for the most part, at least in the Northwest, they're not expecting much of them. They don't say, and you have to quit drugs or and you have to quit booze. So they're allowing people to stay boozed up or drugged up and yet be in these facilities and have the taxpayers pay their rent.
Yeah. Plus, doing that in public makes them accountable to the public, but it also puts them on record as knowing exactly what they did, and if somebody wants to run against them, they have some ammunition to say, look, this is what they approved.
Exactly right. Mark, thanks very much. It's First Amendment Friday on the Radio Northwest Network.
The Lars Larson Show. You need.
when you want it. FM News 101 KXL is Portland's number one source for news and information. KXL FM, Portland, Vancouver, Salem.
This is CBS News on the Hour, your home for original reporting.
I'm Jennifer Kuiper. Multiple sources tell CBS News that the Trump administration is making heavy preparations for the potential use of ground forces in Iran. CBS News military analyst Jeff McCausland.
It does appear that the administration is reviewing this possible option. It furthermore suggests that they assumed at the onset this conflict was going to be relatively easy. There were suggestions the president, in discussion with some foreign leaders, had said that it might only take 3 or 4 days.
Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent says the Trump administration may suspend sanctions on Iranian oil already at sea in an effort to clamp down on energy prices that have skyrocketed. According to CBS's Kelly O'Grady,
the reason why we have seen prices go up so quickly is because we have limited the amount of supply that's going through with the Strait of Hormuz being closed. So this is all to just try and help free up some of that oil and make sure that prices don't go up even further.
The Department of Homeland Security appropriations bill fails in a 47-37 vote. The tally did not change from an hour ago with 16 absences. Over 4,000 people are told to evacuate due to flooding in Hawaii, as officials warn a 120-year-old dam could fail. Hawaii Governor Josh Green.
People have to stay safe. If there was water around your home and you can't get out, go to the upper floors of your house. Meanwhile, we'll have a lot of people going door to door to provide support.
Members of Congress will no longer get special airport security privileges.
Airports around the country allow members of Congress to bypass the usual TSA security screening process at airports nationwide.
Senator John Cornyn introduced the measure.
In other words, they get to skip the line.
Supporters say the change promotes fairness, ensuring lawmakers no longer receive expedited access while the public faces delays. The bill now goes to the House for approval. Stacy Lynn, CBS News, Washington.
A new study suggests a little more physical activity could help prevent type 2 diabetes in teens. Dr. Antonio Cabrera with the American Heart Association.
It's a challenge for teenagers nowadays to find either time or a place to actually dedicate exclusively for 30 minutes of medium or higher intensity activities.
And which he says lowered their insulin resistance by 15%. And Walker, Texas Ranger star and martial artist Chuck Norris has died. His family says they want to keep the circumstances of his death private, but describe it as sudden. He was born Carlos Ray Norris in Oklahoma. He served in the U.S. Air Force during the Korean War, which he began practicing martial arts. He was 86. On Wall Street, the Dow closed down 447 points. This is CBS News.
It's one of the most successful law and justice programs in television history that continues to uncover the truth. 48 Hours, Saturday on CBS and streaming on Paramount.
To First Amendment Friday on the Lars Larson Show.
Friday is for everybody.
Today, Lars puts you in the driver's seat. You talk about what you want to talk about.
Government is the problem.
No topic is off limits.
It looks like the Canadians are here.
Call 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-HEY-LARS.
Thank goodness it's Friday. Happy Friday.
This is
First Amendment Friday with Lars Larson.
Welcome back to Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you on First Amendment Friday. I'll tell you what's been driving me nuts lately. I see all these headlines, and they are both in daily newspapers, but also on television and even some on the radio, in which they question the idea that the Pacific Northwest should dramatically increase the amount of logging that's going on. I mean, these headlines that suggest why the Trump administration could take us back to the bad old days of logging lots and lots of trees in the Pacific Northwest. A new federal plan that would ramp up logging across millions of acres of Oregon. And of course, you know that the purpose of those headlines and the way they're being written is to make you think this is going to be some kind of devastation of Northwest forests, when in fact, it's the one thing that will probably keep the forest from burning down. So I thought I'd get our favorite tree guy, and that is Dr. Bob Zybak, president of Northwest Maps Company and author of several books, most recently the Zybak Forest Anthologies, as well as being a county commissioner candidate in District 5 in Lane County. Dr. Zybak, welcome back.
Thank you, Lars. I enjoyed the introduction.
Now, tell me this. I'm glad you enjoyed it, but do you think I'm right in suggesting that all of the mainstream media that cover this want people to think why logging all those trees would be a terrible thing to do?
I think the main reason is they've been indoctrinated over the last 30 or 40 years. People do not remember when people had jobs and their parks. We didn't have wildfires. We had good parks. We had good schools. We had good roads. We had good hunting and fishing. We had good campgrounds, and that's all being burned up. The rural towns are going broke. The businesses that supported that are going broke, and there's some real opportunity now with the new administration to reverse that trend.
Well, the other thing that I don't notice them doing, and Dr. Zybak, I don't think this is expecting too much, is that they would mention, if we cut at this rate and we replanted the trees as is required by law, both federal law and state law, we'll never run out of trees. We can cut at that rate forever. And most of what they're proposing in these, you know, quadrupling of logging in Oregon forests is well within what's called sustained yield, is it not?
Yeah, exactly. The ONC lands, they only affect 18 counties, four counties in particular, Lane, Douglas, Jackson, and Josephine. 2.3 million acres, grows about 1.3 billion feet a year. And from 1960 to 1990, we cut over a billion feet a year and sold. And it was great for the money goes at that time 50% to the counties. Now it's up to 75% because the other 25% built the roads. But if we go back to that harvest level again, we will never run out of trees. My great-grandkids will have nice forests. We'll have fewer wildfires. We'll put 6,000 or 7,000 people to work and make our roads safer and our schools better.
Well, you would think that they would want to point that out because, I mean, with almost anything else, the media is willing to say this is sustainable or it's not sustainable. Isn't sustained yield where you can cut the same number of trees, create all those jobs and all the tax revenue and everything else, and never run out of trees as long as you always replant what you're cutting? That seems like a positive all day long.
And it's also the law. The 1937 law said that the land will be managed on a sustainable basis and in order because we're not paying taxes. And instead of that, we're on welfare. A secure rural school thing that Wyden put through about 25 years ago was because we weren't managing our lands. And so we depend on welfare. It's a lesser amount. We lose students. We lose workers. We lose businesses. And it's really created a serious problem in our rural areas. And then anybody driving down the highway can see that our forests are being burned up and then allowed to rot or burn again. And it's just a total waste of resources, and it's killing wildlife and polluting the air.
I'm talking to Dr. Bob Zybak, who's not only a forest expert, and been his avocation for his entire professional career, but he's also running for District 5 in Lane County as a county commissioner. Has this gotten the public's attention as you run with it as a campaign issue?
Not yet, but I think it will shortly. That's my whole reason for running, is to bring up these issues. It's not just District 5 Lane County. It's 14 Western Oregon counties, and it's also the National Forest System. 25% of that money by law used to be specifically for county schools and county roads, and that's the things we've lost out. And instead of saving old growth, we've burned up 700,000 acres of old growth with crown fires in the last 25 years on federal land because of neglect and passive management.
No, and in fact, what you could also get out of that is the creation of roads that would get you into and out of those forests. And if you have access, then when they do catch fire, you can actually get to the fires. But without the roads, you can't.
Absolutely. From 52 to 87, as we've discussed several times, there's only one major fire above 10,000 acres in all of Western Oregon. The whole time I worked in the woods, 20 some years, no catastrophic wildfires because we had good roads, we had good trails, and we had people working that had four-wheel drives and walkie-talkies and chainsaws and piscans, and they started lots of fires, undoubtedly, but they put them out.
Okay, so Dr. Zybak, if people want to see information about your campaign, including information about your reaction to the federal plan to dramatically increase logging, where can they find it online?
Zybak for Lane, and I got a donate button.
That's Zybach. Zybak for Lane, and you let people know about it.
Yes, and I've got my platform there and lots of details on it, and happy to correspond with anybody on these issues. We need to reforest our lands.
You know what I'd love to see, Dr. Zybak? We always put naysayers to the head of the line on this show, and it's been one of our hallmarks for 30 years. I'd love to have somebody come on who actually disagrees with dramatically increasing logging in the Northwest. And I'd love to have them debate you or debate me or both. I'd love to have them explain why it makes sense to leave all that timber standing instead of cutting it, replanting it, and keeping the forest healthy. I'd be happy to put them on. If we could get your opponent to come on the air and say, this is why I think Dr. Zybak is wrong, I'd be happy to do that. I think the public would learn a lot.
That would be great, and I'd really support that as well. I sent you an article earlier today, my current draft. It's on that very issue, that we've got this so-called timber wars left over, but there's a debate that's going on now that's bringing up the same point, that the so-called people that won the timber wars are destroying our forests, killing our wildlife, and ruining our rural towns, and they're not being held accountable.
No, they're not. That's Dr. Bob Zybak. He is both a forest scientist and he's running for District 5 in the Lane County Commission in Lane County, Oregon, one of the counties that is so dramatically affected by whether or not we see the Trump administration dramatically increase logging in the Northwest. Bring the jobs, bring the tax revenue. And if anybody wants to debate on that, I'd be glad to talk to them. Glad to take your calls. It's First Amendment Friday, and you're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network.
Surrounded by Northwest liberals.
I cannot stand these morons any longer. If you don't come with me this instant, I shall run amok.
Come to the place where common sense prevails. The Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show on First Amendment Friday. Anthony Martinez writes in from Zilla, Washington. Lars, I totally agree with your opinion about mugshots while wearing face coverings. In this case, we're talking about the hijab that was allowed to be worn by women taken into custody and then getting a mugshot done in Multnomah County. And now the county has come up with a long, complicated procedure that effectively gives women who are Muslim greater rights than almost anybody else or anybody of faith. Well, Anthony writes, Lars, it kind of got me laughing. Several years ago, federal law enforcement were looking for a wanted fellow, and they asked one of our orchard managers, the guy worked at the farm, and they showed him a mugshot. He didn't recognize the guy and said no. A couple of days later, they showed up and arrested their target. They accused us of hiding him. Not the case. He always wore a bandana over his face. Not uncommon among the orchard workers. And that's interesting. Let's go to Steve. Hey, Steve, welcome to First Amendment Friday. What's on your mind?
Hi, Lars. Thanks for taking my call, and thank you for what you do, by the way.
Sure. My
pleasure. Since I had a recent related experience, can you explain to me why we have a shortage of public defenders and how that system works? Is that a county program or state program? How does the system work, and why are we short of defenders?
It's largely a state-funded program, and I'll tell you that at least in the state of Oregon, the amount of funding put to indigent, what they call indigent defense, meaning you can't afford it, is greater than any other, than almost every other state in America, especially when you look at it per capita. And you say, well, how is that? How do we spend more money? And the answer is they cover a public defender for more different kinds of circumstances than the Constitution actually requires. And yet the state of Oregon is very generous when it comes to public defenders. How could you solve the problem? Get the judges to grow some backbones. Any judge sitting in any courtroom could say, I have a man here. He's accused of a crime. Does he have counsel? No. he could look around the room and say, I'm assigning this lawyer to come out and provide him with counsel. And then the lawyer gets paid probably less than he normally gets paid, but he could be assigned as counsel. The judges won't do that. The defense attorneys want to negotiate very fat contracts for indigent defense. And believe me, Steve, the individual lawyers who do indigent defense make a very good living. And if you don't believe me, we've detailed those numbers on the air before, and they're negotiating for more money. And they're apparently not unhappy to let some of the cases simply be dismissed, because that's their negotiating tactic, is until you pay us more, we're not going to provide a defense, and you'll have to dismiss the cases. And this is the argument's been going on for the last couple of years.
Okay, how come the guy with the goofy smile on his face all the time, Mr. Rayfield, who's supposed to be our state attorney general, doesn't do something about this?
Because
the Trump administration over all kinds of other stupid things with other states.
Well, let me tell you, the attorney general for the state could not be on both the prosecution side and the defense side. So it's not his job. Because remember, when you walk into court, if it was a case involving me, it'd be Oregon versus Larson. And I'm the defendant. So you can't be both the attorney general for the state, which is the state side of it, and on the defense side of the as well. It's not his job to provide.
Don't the judges have a dog in the fight then too? Because they're involved in the process.
Yes, they do, but they're supposed to be neutral third parties. And if you believe that, I guess you probably believe in Santa Claus as well. I appreciate the call, Steve, and that's the best answer I can give you. Let's go to Jim. Hey, Jim, it's First Amendment Friday. What's on your mind?
Hey, Lars. Great talking to you. Long-time listener.
Thank you.
I just recently, today here in the last hour or so, got Jeff Merkley's update about his protest with all things voter and voter ID. And I just thought it was time to call in to his office and make a complaint about that, because I do not agree with that view. I think there's so many things, as you've highlighted on your show, that you have to have ID for all throughout your life. I think voting is one of them. So I called his office and I complained and left a little note there, talked to the lady. I called the Washington, D.C. office, and I found it kind of strange when I hung up that they never verified my address, what county I'm from or what state I'm from, when I actually called in to make that complaint. So I guess it just follows with their policy.
I think if they know that you're not in favor of Senator Merkley, it's an election year. He doesn't give a damn about you at all. He knows you're not going to vote for him, so why would he care?
And that's probably true as well.
And by the way, Merkley is one of these people who's running for re-election in a year where Democrats say we cannot allow the SAVE Act to pass the U.S. Senate. And I don't think Merkley could explain why he says that passing the SAVE Act is going to stop Americans from voting. It's not going to stop citizens from voting. Citizens will be able to vote. But you see, I think the Democrats use a fungible definition of what an American is. They consider an American anyone who happens to be standing on this continent. They don't, and not necessarily a U.S. citizen. But to be able to vote legally, you have to be a U.S. citizen. And Merkley is making the argument against it. He says it's going to eliminate vote by mail. Well, maybe it will, and maybe it should. Maybe we should get rid of vote by mail because it's an untrustworthy system. But I appreciate the call. Let's go to Stephen. Hey, Stephen, welcome to the program. What's on your mind?
Afternoon, Lars. I have a question. I know that, everybody's innocent until proven guilty. But yep. I'm just wondering why these Washington Democrats, U.S. senators, state senators, the governor, aren't saying anything about this 25-year-old transgender woman raping a 7-year-old child. Everybody's allegedly...
Which case are you talking... What town are you talking about this happening in? That one doesn't ring a bell. Tacoma?
Tacoma. It happened 2 days ago, 2 or 3 days ago in Tacoma.
Is the person a teacher? Because that one doesn't ring a bell.
25-year-old transgender woman.
Yeah.
Okay? And he sexually assaulted a 7-year-old child, 7-month
child. Charged with, yep.
Yep. Why aren't these Democrats saying anything about the morality of, what do they stand for?
How about forget about morality. Take a look at, is this a crime? for any adult person to go out and commit a sexual act against a child. You don't have to go to morality. This is an accusation that a former employee at a Tacoma shelter has been arrested and charged with sexually assaulting a six-month-old girl about 3 years ago. Stephen, we'll put it back on the list for Monday to talk about that then, and I appreciate the call.
Thank you.
The Lars Larson Show. Something to say? Give Lars a call at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-HEY-LARS. Now, back to the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you on a First Amendment Friday, and always glad to get to your phone calls and emails at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk at LarsLarson.com. Let me start with George. Hey, George, welcome to the program. What's on your mind?
Hey, Lars, I wanted to talk to you about the Government Union Teachers Employment Act, better known as the Arts Tax in Portland.
What a joke, right?
Yeah, what a joke. You know, this is an insidiously horrible tax. Number one, it's double taxation because they charge you for school taxes on your property taxes, and then they want to hit you again with another $35 tax for one particular subject. And then if that isn't bad enough, it's a tax which is burdensome on the poor because they charge this tax to anyone who makes as little as $1,000 a year.
Yep. That means that a young lady or a young man who mows lawns or does babysitting or any of those kind of jobs would make enough money to qualify to be taxed by this. And by the way, have you seen the most recent audit of that tax where they determined that the city, after 10 years of collecting it, can't even tell you that the money is going to the purpose they said it would go to?
Yes, it doesn't even cover arts.
No, it's supposed to hire a new art teacher. Apparently, they've not been very successful at that. Let's go to James in Everett, Washington. Hey, James, welcome to the program. What's on your mind on a First Amendment Friday?
Well, Lars, I just wanted to talk about property taxes. Okay. I have a meeting with, it's taken me 3 weeks to get it. And anyway, long story short, I wanted to talk to Brian Sullivan about my property taxes. And
who is Brian Sullivan for the rest of us who don't know Brian by name? Who is he?
He's a Snohomish County treasurer.
Okay.
Yeah. And it's like I said, it's taken me about 3 weeks to work up to the, you know, the head of the snake. And long story short, I just wanted him to explain to me how my property taxes, I've lived in my house for 20 years, and how it could go up 300% over that amount of time. And my wages go up by, you know, less than 50%. And that's, you know, I get to, you know, that's it in a nutshell. But I'm just so frustrated because it's just not that. You know, my sewer and water has gone up by over 300%. My electricity has gone up by 200%. My natural gas bill has just gone up by 300%. In fact,
that's a private company. Yeah. Okay. So, James, I guess what I'm wondering is, I've got the same frustration you do of property taxes going up. How much of it could be explained by you doing your own research without talking to the county treasurer, auditor, whoever it is, and just say, my fellow taxpayers have voted through various levies and other obligations that have added to your property tax. Is that not the case?
Well, it is the case, but, you know, Lars, is you live in Washington State. We have motor voter here. And
I don't trust it either.
What's that?
I don't trust it either. So yeah, it is the system.
It's a way for theft. That's what it is.
Well, except James, if your fellow taxpayers did legitimately vote additional levies for the fire department, for the schools, for all the other elements of government, then that's the system we live in, where you say, we want more taxes, we're going to let the citizens vote on it. I don't like the outcome of it, but that is one of the outcomes. Is it illegitimate that the people who live in a county can vote more taxes to pay for other services?
Well, yeah, legitimate citizens of Snohomish County can vote to raise taxes, but I don't think that's what's going on here. This is a huge sanctuary infested neighborhood, and I think, you know, the votes are already counted before they even process one of these levies.
And you might be right about that, and I appreciate the call. Let's go to Dean. Hey, Dean, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. What's on your mind?
IP-28. I was curious as to how they plan on enforcing that.
You mean the one that would ban all fishing, all hunting, all farming,
exactly,
all ranching, yeah, that involves the death of an animal altogether?
Yeah, because you know what's going to happen if Oregonians are stupid enough to pass that thing. Pest control products are going to fly off the shelves, everything from bug spray to mouse traps, and quite possibly poaching will get out of hand.
I think you're right about that, because, Dean, and beyond that, if there is no ban in, say, Washington State or Idaho or California, then people in Oregon are going to say, I have to control pests on my property. I'll just buy the stuff elsewhere, but I'll use it here. And how they're going to actually enforce it, I don't know, because this literally would, for you would not be allowed to put out bait to kill mice, to kill rats, to kill any of the other pests that you have out there. All of that would be forbidden. And I don't even know how they're going to harvest food at all, because when you run a combine, when you run these various pieces of farm equipment, you're going to end up inadvertently killing rodents, killing snakes, sometimes even killing birds. So that sounds like it's going to make harvesting almost any kind of food, even vegetable food, is going to become illegal.
So
good luck staying alive. Well, you'll be buying your food from another state. I appreciate the call. Let's go to Richard. Hey, Richard, welcome to the program. What's on your mind?
Well, thank you once again, Lars. Kennewick man here, and I'd like to talk about the three branches of government, but the one that has control, yeah, I believe, is a judicial branch, the judges. And as I understand it, the ratio is about 25%. Only 25% of them have conservative, let's say, values.
Yeah.
The other 75% are liberals, and the independents, of course, are somewhere in between, but still, they pretty much run the country. You see the interference they give President Trump right now.
Yep.
We need to promote conservative thought through our law schools. Thank you very much, Lars. Great listening to you.
Thank you very much. I appreciate the call. Let me get one more call in. Robert, welcome to the program. What's on your mind?
Yeah, I was just talking about the Muslims. They're wearing the hijabs or whatever it is.
Yep.
You suppose that's going to make the libs have to identify what a woman is, or can a trans woman look at the Muslim women?
You know, that's an interesting point, because they could just say, well, we've decided that all the male sheriffs, when they're looking at the picture of the Muslim woman who doesn't have her hijab on, they just all identify as women at that point. And you're right. Under the new liberal woke rules, they'd be able to avoid all of that. Coming up in a moment, we got to talk about AI, and the White House is pushing one national rule book for artificial intelligence. That's next.
Disagree with Lars? Great. Naysayers go first at 866-HEY-LARS.
Now, back to the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. I've admitted to you before that I'm deeply skeptical about artificial intelligence known as AI. But now the White House is pushing to have one national set of rules for AI instead of allowing each of the states to independently regulate artificial intelligence. I thought we'd talk to Mark Beal about that, who's president of government affairs at the AI Policy Network and a former Pentagon AI policy director. Mark, welcome back.
Hey, how you doing?
Not too bad. Does it make any sense at all to have 50 different sets of regulations in the 50 states? I guess 51 if you include D.C., 58 if you're an Obama voter, or does it make more sense to have one? I had to say that. One national standard that regulates AI?
I mean, of course, it makes a complete sense to have one national standard. And, you know, for the last 18 months, as this issue has become more and more salient and these technologies have become more and more powerful, Congress simply hadn't been doing its job. And so it's not unsurprising that the states stepped into the leadership vacuum and then tried to do something. But now, I think happily, after a big political set of fights last year on this, that the White House and Congress seem to be moving in the direction of establishing that one national framework. And that's going to be really, really important for the industry.
I mean, why is the Congress so reluctant to jump into this thing? I mean, ordinarily they love to assert the fact that they're in control of things.
Well, you know, it's interesting. AI is a bit of a stinker politically. I think many people are looking at the polling and they're seeing this overwhelming anxiety and skepticism. I think, like you and I may share, on where this technology is going and who it's going to be benefiting and what it means for the future of labor, what it means for child safety, what it means for copyright, what it means for national security. And I think, and the other thing is that there's just a lot of tech lobbying happening on Capitol Hill. And so, like, their Congress, they may feel kind of damned if they do, damned if they know. But given where things are today, they've kind of been forced to take on the mantle. And, you know, looking at the vote count, we'll see how successful they'll be.
Well, and how much limitation do you want put on this technology? Because I hear people saying, but it's going to replace a lot of jobs. I said, well, there are lots of technologies that have replaced lots and lots of jobs over the decades. It's just they tended to come in a lot more slowly. I mean, if I walked into a warehouse 100 years ago and there were a whole bunch of guys in the warehouse moving boxes around, and today you walk in and there's a few forklifts moving everything around, or maybe even automation that's moving everything around, you say that automation replaced a lot of people, but it did it fairly slowly over a period of time. This is coming all at once. So how do we accommodate that?
You nailed it. The velocity of this thing is what I think everyone has some concerns about. You know, the Industrial Revolution, it played out over a period of, what, 150 years or something?
Yeah.
Here we are in the AI world happening in less than a decade. And the other thing here is, like, when we automated, basically what the Industrial Revolution did is it automated human physical strength out of the economy. It basically zeroed that out as a function of overall economic output. Now we're talking about doing the same thing, but with our intellectual labor, right? And so I think, and the verdict's sort of out on what the future looks like, because there's one of two scenarios. One scenario is that people will be upstream of the AI, will be directing the AI to do productive things in the economy, and they'll be the ones that benefit. And that's the optimistic point of view. The scary one is that if people become not just unemployed, but unemployable, because the entire economy is automated and then there's no room left for people, and then I think that's going to be a big question. It's going to have massive political ramifications. It's going to have massive ramifications for the free market. And the reality is, like, nobody knows exactly where all of this is headed.
Well, and in fact, if you just hold it back with regulations, all you're going to do is delay the inevitable. But Mark, shouldn't we have worried over the years that there were lots and lots of these things that would have happened, except we always found other things for human beings to do? Is that still going to be the case? Does anybody have a crystal ball that says, hey, despite all the stuff that AI will start doing, you human beings will still have functions you'll do where your labor will be valuable?
I mean, I certainly hope so. And I think that's certainly a message coming out of some corners of this administration and out of the tech industry itself. The vision is that, look, AI will come online, will automate large sections of the economy. The cost of goods and services will decline very rapidly to the point where money may be less meaningful than it is today. And one sort of, like, if you look at some people like Elon Musk, what he would say is that, you know, human beings might not actually need to work, and we might be able to spend our time doing other things, right? Of course, that's every time, you know, in history we've seen promises of these utopian societies, thinking about, like, the Bolsheviks. You know, we sort of know where that ends, though. We know it ends in the gulag, and we don't certainly want to see it become a society of techno-feudal serfs. But yeah, I think the bottom line is that no one really knows where this is headed. It's an exciting time. It's a scary time. I think you're looking at the polling. People are feeling very anxious about their jobs. They're working with these AI systems. They're inputting them. They're asking the AI systems things that their boss would ask them, and they're seeing the AI systems deliver better results in some cases. So I think there's definitely a lot of trepidation, but of course we can't be afraid. This is not going to go anywhere. We can't regulate it out of existence. We just got to kind of deal with it head on and figure out the plan.
I'm talking to Mark Beal, who's a government affairs guy, president of government affairs at AI Policy Network. See, I'm concerned about having a huge number of unemployed, unemployable, and bored, mostly younger people, because that doesn't seem like it has a good outcome long term. Is that a concern we should worry about, too?
It's a huge concern. I mean, we sort of saw a taste of this during the COVID shutdown. You know, people were told they couldn't work. They had to stay in their houses. They had to wear their masks and get vaccinated. And, you know, alcoholism was on the rise. Domestic violence was on the rise. You know, human beings, like, we have to understand human nature and meet that where it is and not take a rose-colored glasses look at that. People need purpose. People need to have an outlet. People need to be engaged productively. And if they're not, then I think bad outcomes can happen. So I think that's absolutely a concern. You know, on the other side, you know, you might see a scenario in which, you know, one person who's not even technical can create a new business and have AI do a whole bunch of work for them and create all kinds of value in the economy and benefit in that way. And we certainly hope that's the future that we're moving toward. But I think the problem is no one really knows. And we definitely need to start thinking about a plan B in case we're in a situation in which that doesn't come to fruition.
Let's hope that that's the case. Mark Beal is president of government affairs at the AI Policy Network. Mark, it's a pleasure to have you on the show. Back in just a moment. It's First Amendment Friday. Your calls are welcome at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. And you're listening to the Radio Northwest Network.
The Lars Larson Show.
First Amendment Friday on the Lars Larson Show.
Friday is for everybody.
Today, Lars puts you in the driver's seat. You talk about what you want to talk about.
Government is the problem.
No topic is off limits.
They look like the Canadians are here.
Call 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-HEY-LARS.
Thank goodness it's Friday. Happy Friday.
This is
First Amendment Friday with Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. Welcome to First Amendment Friday. On First Amendment Friday, everything is fair game. We open up the phone lines and you can comment on anything. Now, I want to put this in front of you. Washington State has just passed a law, and it's been signed by Governor Bob Ferguson, that allows changes to official records involving sex and whether or not somebody is identified as male or female, or I guess if they call it non-binary, neither. And I thought we'd ask our friend Representative Jim Walsh about this, state representative for Washington's 19th legislative district. Representative Walsh, this sounds like they're going to destroy public records by not letting you find out whether somebody is even a man or a woman.
Yeah, it's a really dumb bill now, law, Lars. It's bad. It continues a pattern we've seen with the left in Washington State weaponizing the state's Department of Health. That's the agency that would do this. And yeah, what the bill says and now law is they can change medical records, healthcare records of individuals, state government-run healthcare records, with regard to their sex, to their gender identity. And it's not just a going forward thing. It's not that getting a new driver's license or a new document, they can change their gender. They can go back and change old records, you know, true health records, and reverse them and change the sex identity, gender identity of an individual on a record of birth certificate or other older records. And that's very dangerous, in my opinion. I mean, it may not seem as bad as the state income tax and a pension raid and other issues that get more attention, but this is bad. I mean, it allows a state bureaucratic agency to be weaponized and basically lie, go back and say things that aren't true and weren't true in the past.
Well, let me ask you this, Representative Walsh. I mean, this may seem like a dumb question, but if somebody, because we know there are plenty of people who now call themselves women, but they are still biologically men. And of course, nothing's going to change their DNA. That's going to stay. But even if they've had the surgery and the hormones and everything else, but does this allow you to go in and make changes and say, I want the official state record to reflect that I'm now female, even if you haven't had the changes made?
That's correct. And it is. I mean, it's kind of like George Orwell stuff, Lars. I mean, it's the Ministry of Truth, not the Ministry of Health.
Where war is peace and all that.
Exactly. They're going back and saying things that are scientifically, factually false and putting it into a public record. And it's not like it's a mistake. They are intentionally going back and falsifying public records. And that is a bad precedent. It's a bad thing to do. Forget the details. Don't, you know, people say, well, it's kind to these individuals and it helps them with their self-image and their self-identity. Well, okay, maybe that's true. It's also false. And I take a great amount of umbrage at people who claim to be science-based and fact-based perpetuating this lie. I mean, this is codifying and bureaucratizing lies in public documents.
Well, and let me ask you on a practical basis, you've got somebody, say, who is a convicted sex offender. Now, I think most people would look at a male convicted sex offender and see far more hazard or threat in a male than a female. So the sex offender goes down and gets his gender changed to female, then holds himself out as female, and he manages to effectively conceal himself from a lot of what's going on, you know, in the neighborhood. Because I get notifications when it says, hey, this convicted sex offender has moved into within a mile of your house, and I get those notifications. If they change it from male to female or vice versa, that may help to allow that person to camouflage what they're doing. And I can imagine illicit uses of that, but that's going to be allowed. And there's no limitation on how much people want to change from one to the other, is there?
Correct. It really will make a mockery of the idea that the public documents are reliable. It just makes them clownish. They're not. People aren't going to be able to rely on public documents in the state of Washington, and that's very bad. And remember, a lot of these sex predators and sexual deviants, they're sort of cunning. They're what law enforcement calls low cunning. They're manipulators. They see a system and they look for ways to take advantage of the system, whatever the system is. And this is one such system now that a predatory personality, a sociopath, can look for ways to manipulate. This is going to be an easy tool for manipulation of public documents.
And allowing them to hide because your official driver's license and other documents are going to identify you as one way, even though that one way does not at all comport with the actual physical facts on the ground. Any reason did Ferguson even talk about whether or not he had questioned signing this thing?
No, and when we debated it, it was pretty much bipartisan. It was very partisan as it went through the legislature. There were a couple, I think, of members on each side who voted against their group, but it was pretty much a party line vote. And we did discuss it both in committee and on the floor that this was something that could be easily weaponized. It could be exploited. And it just debases the truth. And we opened up some of these issues you and I are discussing now, but the majority just ignored it, and the governor's office hasn't acknowledged any of it. They're just trying to virtue signal this, but it's more dangerous than that. I think it has long-term repercussions with the reliability and trustworthiness of any state government document in Washington.
And by the way, the legislation also says the state archives are not allowed to have any other documentation as to the fact that the changes have been made, which means there won't be any historical trace where you can say, well, somebody had this change from male to female or female to male way back then, because the law actually says you have to keep all of that secret. It doesn't make any sense. Representative Walsh, thanks very much. I appreciate your time. So Representative Jim Walsh, who represents the 19th Legislative District, I'd love to talk to the Democrats who actually signed this thing. I mean, Governor Bob Ferguson saying anytime Washingtonians want to be able to change their sex designation on official state IDs and birth certificates, they can do it, and there's no question, and there will be no historical trace that the change has even been made. Glad to be with you and glad to take your phone calls and your emails. It's a First Amendment Friday, and your calls are welcome at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. And this segment of the show is brought to you by NickShivers.com. For a guaranteed outcome to sell your house, just go to NickShivers.com. That's NickShivers.com. And our ex-poll question today, should Muslim suspects be able to have their mug shots taken while wearing a face-covering hijab? You can find the X-Poll at Lars Larson Show and at LarsLarson.com, and brought to you by Ultimate Truck Service. You can find them at UltimateTruckService.com. Hey, you...
reads every email. No, really. Talk@LarsLarson.com. That's talk@LarsLarson.com. Now, back to the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show on First Amendment Friday. I thought this was a perfect day to talk about this because the Taxpayers Association of Oregon, I thought, made a fantastic case that Lloyd Center, one of the oldest malls in all of America, is really unique. It has a lot of things to recommend it, and yet it is basically being put to death by some of the policies that it's surrounded by because it's sitting in Portland, Oregon. I mean, they point out that it was the nation's largest open-air shopping mall. It was famous for having a year-round ice skating rink. Robert F. Kennedy Jr. and his wife even, not junior, but senior, even went skating on the rink, and as well as Tonya Harding, of course. Newberry's had its largest store in America at the mall. It had all these things going for it, and yet it is being put to death to the point where they're talking about redeveloping the entire property and essentially just bulldozing it. Well, Matt Henderson wants to make sure that doesn't happen. He's the lead organizer of the Save Lloyd campaign, and he joins me now. Matt, welcome back to the program.
Hey, Lars. First time on the program, but thanks for that intro. Appreciate
well, sorry. Sorry for overstating it. I thought we had talked to you before, but you've been out gathering signatures to Save Lloyd. Is it still possible to make it happen?
Well, we'll admit that it seems more and more like a moonshot at this point. I mean, it was all along. The property is owned by an out-of-state private equity monolith out of New York called KKR. And the thing is, they look to optimize any sort of asset in their portfolio, and they're trying to do the same thing with Lloyd Center. And the trouble with that we see is Lloyd Center, as you pointed out, has this long history in the community. Ever since it was built in 1960, it's been a destination for Portlanders. And like many places, in many cities, it's fallen on hard times, especially since the pandemic, right? So
yep,
what we've
true.
Seen is that it is emerging as this sort of cultural epicenter again. And interestingly, the reason behind that is that the mall started renting, albeit for very affordable rates, under market rates to all sorts of different creative businesses and galleries and nonprofits and all sorts of youth and family-related programming. And anyway, so it really is becoming an attraction again, and the local press has taken notice. There was all sorts of great press around the mall just within the past year. So the timing is really tragic that this is the year that there's the impending closure, and their plan is to completely demolish the mall. So.
I mean, because Matt, you make a good case. I mean, it's and look, I've gone to Lloyd Center, you know, basically since I was a teenager, and I lived in Tillamook, and we'd come to Portland, we'd go to Lloyd Center. It was a real unique place, even around the country. But the Taxpayers Association points out it has been beset by crime, by vandalism, by drugs, all of which has been encouraged by some of the crazy decisions in the state of Oregon. It has high wages that have to be paid because of the state's or the city's requirements on wage laws. Electricity costs have gone up something like 50% in the last 5 years. So it's got all those things working against it. Is there enough a good to balance off against all the things that are working against its continued operation as a mall?
Yeah, I mean, it's difficult in a short time to speak to all those things you just mentioned, but one thing I will say is the security situation in and around the mall has really improved. The owners, even given their plans to, you know, wind things down here, they did reinvest in security in the mall. And so that's really improved. And that was one reason why a number of the anchor tenants fled in recent times. I mean, in addition to just, you know, people shopping less retail, but they, there was a lot of product loss in the mall in recent years. That's improved a lot. And you know what guards against the types of ailments that you just described is when communities actually come together and actually hold the center of a space. And that's what's been happening increasingly in the past 3 years. And it got to a point where it was just so clear that this was a win. This was a win for Portland's community at a time when we know, you know, our reputation suffers locally and nationally. And this, to me, you know, if we could just convince the city and even the current owners or some future prospective owner, if anyone wants to come forward, anyone is extremely well-resourced who wants to invest in this vision, there is an opportunity here to have something that is a real attraction in Portland. And that's what Lloyd Center has been over, you know, many years. But a redefined sort of answer to what can be done with these failing shopping malls.
That's a good question. Matt, thank you very much. I appreciate having you come on. That's Matt Henderson from Save Lloyd. Let's go to James, who's a naysayer on this First Amendment Friday. James, what do you and I disagree about today?
How you doing, Lars? Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Just disagree a little bit on the on your take on Kent, the way you explained it as far as him saying that it wasn't an intimate danger or threat. And it seems like you're just complicit with everything that Trump is saying. Well, not everything, but a good percentage of it. And I think that we listen to go back to see what Trump said when he first bombed Iran. He said that he totally wiped out their nuclear capabilities and that he also took out some people along the way. And then a few days later, it came out that they didn't totally wipe it out, but they set them back a few years.
Yeah.
So if that's the case, if that truly happened, well, then how was it an imminent threat that they were being attacked?
You mean imminent? Yeah. How is it still an imminent threat? I think it is still an imminent threat. They are still a major sponsor of terrorism on planet Earth, and I think that we had to act against that. And whatever the president knows is information that the rest of us do not have access to, and that is no matter how much we knocked out by bombing their nuclear program earlier, if they are not out of the nuclear weapons creation business altogether, the president would have that information. We would not. Is that not fair to say?
Well, that is true. But he would. But Kim would also have it too, though.
I mean, because Joe Kent was cut out of the presidential briefing several months ago because they suspected him of leaking, which means he would have been cut out of the loop. Does that make sense?
Well, yes, yeah, that can definitely be the talking point, but neither one of us really know. Is that correct?
Well, I do know this. Was he cut out of the loop? Yep. Is the FBI now investigating him for leaking? Yep. Did he know what was going on? I don't think so.
The Lars Larson Show.
Experience matters.
Speak now or forever hold your peace. 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-HEY-LARS. Now, back to the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you on a First Amendment Friday. And this segment of the show is brought to you by Oregon Medical Centers, the regenerative medical specialists at Oregon Medical Centers. And our expert question, should Muslim suspects be able to have their mugshots taken while wearing a face-covering hijab? That is going to be the new rule because the Multnomah County Sheriff's Office has agreed to it to settle a lawsuit that was brought against or brought by CARE, that is the Council on American Islamic Relations. Should Muslim suspects be able to have mugshots taken while wearing a face-covering hijab? I would say no to that. You can answer it any way you like. You'll find the question at Lars Larson Show and at LarsLarson.com and brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at UltimateTruckService.com. Let me go first to Tim. Hey, Tim, welcome to First Amendment Friday. What's on your mind?
Hey, thank you for having me, Lars. I appreciate that.
Sure.
Recently, of course, it's this week, we had a publication come out from the Oregon Department of Transportation and the Portland Police, and they listed the number of drunk drivers that were arrested during the St. Patrick's Day holiday.
Yeah.
And I'll just be straight up and say there are a lot of people who are on our roads that don't belong there.
Agreed.
60 people supposedly were arrested for driving impaired. I'll call it that because I don't know all the circumstances. But here's the thing. It's been a personal observation for a long time. I've had 5 drunk drivings in my lifetime.
Wow.
The last one was 35 years ago because eventually we all grow up. But if you're a person who goes after work, for example, and maybe you have a couple of drinks with people where you work, and for whatever reason, new blood pressure medication or not enough sleep, or it could be anything, and you're out with some friends, and you go, wow, this couple of drinks has really hit me. I don't want to drive home. Well, in the old days, you leave your car at the bar, you park it at the supermarket, you go around the corner. That option is gone because who owns the streets after 7 o'clock at night are the towing companies. They're out there in a very proactive position where they'll go to any place that's closed, and if they got a sign up there that says XYZ towing, they'll tow you away. And it's hundreds of dollars. And I think people make, not all of the 60 people that were arrested, but I think in the mix there, if they're really trying to cut back on drunk driving, what's your alternative? Oh, yeah, you can get an Uber or you can take a bus. By the way, the bus schedule after a certain time, they're like an hour, hour and a half apart. Or because TriMet's cut back, some of the late evening stuff isn't even running anymore.
You know, I've got an idea for you, Tim. Here's a business opportunity. Why don't you call it Drunk Share and have the ride share companies say we'll have a certain number of ride shares, Ubers and Lyfts, and they'll have a second person in the car. And what they agree to do, and you sign off on it, I don't care if you're intoxicated or not, but you agree to let them drive your car home. So they follow you home, they put somebody behind the wheel in your car, and they drive your car home for an extra fee. Would that be worth it?
Well, it could very well be, but the only information that most of us have is TriMet is free, and schedules and their routes or whatever they are, and then you can always take an Uber.
Yeah, and you can take an Uber and come back and get your car tomorrow morning. Tim, thanks for the call. Let's go to Darlene. Hey, Darlene, welcome to the Lars Larson Show on First Amendment Friday. What's on your mind?
Well, thank you, Lars. It's like I'm talking with an old friend because I've been listening to you off and on for a long time.
Thank you,
ma'am. I want to start out with, I'm an 88-year-old woman. I am a Christian, and I'm a Republican. I have worked for with the Republican candidates since I was 28 years old.
You got a lot going for you.
And I've enjoyed some successes. We have, but my concern now is recently we had a gentleman that was going to run for Congress, and I run into this too often. He is declaring he is pro-life and almost like pounding his chest. Now, on August 26th in 1920, women got to have the vote.
Yeah.
That's pretty great. But today, we do not have control over our bodies.
And how so?
But just a minute. I have been on Rape Relief and Battered Women board a few years ago. So when you have a 12, 13, 14, 15-year-old girl pregnant, you want them to carry and deliver a baby?
Yes.
That damages their little bodies? Do you want a woman?
Well, if the doctor says this is medically dangerous to the young lady, to the girl, then in those cases they can terminate the pregnancy. But otherwise, why would you want to terminate a pregnancy when young ladies have been having births at that age for literally thousands of years, and you would justify that to kill the baby, Darlene?
Well, let's just take it right away. We discover the pregnancy. Let's just take it right away.
Kill it. You mean kill it? Kill the child, right?
Well, it's not really a baby yet. It's just a...
Isn't it?
But
have you ever told a friend who's pregnant, hey, congratulations on your lump?
Yeah, well, it's almost like we have a Sharia law for women.
No, women have their freedom to, how that baby was produced. Women have the freedom to have sex with somebody, to create a child, and then they have the freedom to decide what they're going to do. But you want them to simply kill the unborn child, Darlene. I can't agree with that. Why would you think that's justified?
Well, I know that that's what you think. I've heard you say that. And quite frankly, I don't think men should have an opinion.
Aren't they half the process of creating that child?
Well, if a man has raped and...
No, we're not talking about rape. We're talking about consent. Is a man half of that process that created the child? Darlene, good naysayer call, and I appreciate it on a First Amendment Friday. You've got the Lars Larson Show.
The Lars Larson Show.